This episode is brought to you by Bombas. The kids are back in school, vacations are over, and it's officially the start of cozy season, which means time to slide into some Bombas. You know Bombas, the most comfortable socks, slippers, tees, and underwear that are out there, made from premium materials that actually make sense for this time of year. Listen, my wife and I are huge fans of Bombas. I have probably a dozen pairs. They are my favorite socks. Actually, when I'm out of Bombas socks in my wash cycle, I get a little depressed, but it's a good motivation for me to get my wash done, which is something I don't like to do. And this season, Bombas has the softest materials. Think merino wool. It keeps you warm when it's chilly out, but cool when it's hot. Supima cotton, that's softer, stronger, and more breathable than regular cotton. And even rag wool, the thick, durable, classic cozy sock that you'll want all fall. And the best part, Bombas has a great mission. For every item you buy, Bombas donates one to someone experiencing homelessness. Over 150 million items have been donated thanks to customers. And Bombas has a happiness guarantee. If you're not 100% into what you got, they'll make it right. No risk, all reward. Head over to bombas.com/curb and use the code CURB for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/curb and use the code CURB at checkout.
The Curb Sliders Podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of those and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly Cash Like More Hustle and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're ready.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders.
Well, hello, Matt. How are you doing?
I'm okay. Yeah. I mean, Paul's kids? Not here, so...
Well, yeah. How are that. His kids?
But Carolyn Chan is here. Hi, Carolyn.
Hey, how are you guys?
Well, hi.
Carolyn, this is not your first time helping out the show, but your first time on air, so I didn't really prepare you for this, but why don't you give some sort of one-liner about yourself?
Yeah, so I am Carolyn. I'm a 28-year-old female, and my last year of my internal medicine residency at University Hospitals in Cleveland. So in my spare time, I love to go to shows, like any sort of live theater shows, like storytelling, comedy. But also, I'm always like surprised at the weird shows you can find in town, even out of Cleveland. So last week, a couple weeks ago, actually, I went to this show that was cabaret / magic / burlesque / drag show, and it was incredible.
Sounds incredible.
So plug for local theater.
Says your skills include improv comedy.
Yes, I do. I have an improv troupe that I perform with out in Cleveland called Asking for a Friend.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, we read our like middle school journals out loud, and that's our suggestion. It's really fun and like terrifying at the same time.
Yeah. So you decided we're not going to go with audience suggestions. We're just going to embarrass ourselves by reading our middle school journals.
Pretty much. We let them choose a journal. So all four of us each kept a journal. So we like have an audience vote, and then they pick a page, and then we're committed. That's it. We're all in. No skipping.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry that I'm not living in Cleveland to come check that out. All right. Well, we should probably set up the show because we had such a wonderful guest tonight. This was Dr. Glockenflecken, which you might have heard of him on Twitter because he is a world-renowned anonymous ophthalmologist on Twitter.
Eye dentist.
And when he's not treating eyeballs at his real-life private practice job, he is writing funny things on the internet. So Dr. Glockenflecken is a regular contributor and editor for Gomer Blog, and his writing has been featured on Kevin MD, Doximity, The Ophthalmologist, and PubMed, which was by mistake. He is most famous for telling people how to properly use an eyedrop bottle, and you can follow him on Twitter at Dr. Glockenflecken. I'll spell it out for you. Dr. Dr. Glockenflecken, or I could just put a link in the show notes, which I will. And you can find his writing on Gomer Blog. His charity is First Descents, which is a charity for young people suffering from cancer. And the charity sponsors week-long outdoor events for young people with cancer. So you should check that out at firstdescents.org, and you can make a donation if you see fit. And special thanks to Nora Toronto, who is acting as a producer on this show and helped with the show notes and the other pre and post production. Thank you, Nora.
Excellent. And Matt, I don't know about you, but I had a ball.
And this is a very special episode of the Curbsiders because we have with us tonight Dr. Glockenflecken, who is world famous on Twitter and also for his writing on Gomer Blog. And we're so excited to have him here.
That's right. And I found out tonight that he's not Rand Paul.
Right.
Yeah. Dr. G, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, it's great to be here. I just want to say that was a great pronunciation of Glockenflecken. That was fantastic.
I'm going to retire right now. Stuart, if you could finish the interview.
No, that's okay. I'm good to go.
I'd like to ask you our first question. Dr. G, everyone wants to know, how would you describe yourself in a one-liner?
Well, I'd say I'm a 32-year-old comedy writer masquerading around as a comprehensive ophthalmologist. I have borderline hyperlipidemia.
Excellent.
Controlled with diet and exercise currently.
Mm. I've got some Zocor for you.
Oh, do you? Am I at that point yet? I'm hoping to avoid it, but I think I'm getting there. That really just about sums up who I am as a one-liner.
So I have a question for you, Dr. G. What is the best medical advice you've ever received as a learner?
I'd say don't interrupt the nurses during sign out.
Very true. Very true.
Hands down, the best advice I received as a learner. Definitely.
Excellent. So Dr. G, is there any book that you think that every physician should read?
Well, I'm a little bit biased because I write for Gomer Blog. So I'm going to have to say House of God, which I've read multiple times and
excellent.
Get something different out of it every single time.
I think we've asked this before to other guests, but did you have a favorite rule from the House of God?
Oh gosh, you're putting me on the spot.
I think mine is probably, if you don't want to find a fever, don't check for a fever.
I can't believe you didn't say rule number one, Gomers don't die. Because he writes for Gomer Blog.
Never die. That's a, yeah. I like the, there's no body cavity you can't reach with a
14 gauge.
14 gauge and a good strong arm or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. Since you are a surgeon, sir, I figured, that's a good one for you.
That is a much larger needle than anything that I have used in a long time.
Okay. So you're not using 14 gauge needles on the eyes? Is that what you're saying?
But you can reach any part of the eye with a 30 gauge needle.
Okay.
That's at least a couple inches long.
Oh, geez.
Ouch.
And probably
that just feels worse. Like
you can probably reach some parts of the brain too with a several inch long needle from the eye. How about an app that you could recommend to the audience?
I mean, can I say Twitter? Because that's by far the app that I'm on the most, pretty much constantly.
Yeah.
I mean, as a resident.
You ever offer that app?
Well, as a resident, I used Browzine. I don't know if you, this is like
the journal one, right?
Yeah, it's like a bookshelf that you can keep journals in. And it was just really helpful for being able to quickly reference any articles. I'm a private practice attending now, so I only read throwaway journals that are heavily sponsored by industry.
And so
that app hasn't really been as helpful anymore, and I stick with Twitter and don't read anything more than like 280 characters.
Okay.
At a time.
That's very honest of you. I appreciate the honesty. Carolyn, what do you think? Should we move on to the case now?
Yeah, let's go for it. So today, from Cash Lock Memorial, we have Miss M. So she is a 38-year-old African-American female with no significant past medical history. So she's coming to your office today because she's having this unilateral red eye that she's been having for about a week. So over the course of the week, she's kind of developed this photophobia, and now she's having this like mild burning sensation in her right eye. She does wear contacts intermittently and confesses to you that occasionally she does indeed fall asleep in them. Since her red eye symptoms started, she has stopped wearing her contacts as they seem to make her symptoms worse. So she's tried all the over-counter like Visine red eye drops, but nothing that she tried seemed to help at all. She also states that she's been having some of this like watery discharge coming from that same eye, but states that she hasn't noticed like any purulence or any pus sort of coming out of it. So Dr. G is sort of like, based on just her history alone, do you think she would warrant an urgent evaluation by an ophthalmologist?
Yeah, are you guys trying to trigger me? Is that is that what you're doing? Sleeping in contact lenses, Visine. You didn't. I'm sure she also got an eyeball tattoo a couple of weeks ago.
How did you know?
Yeah, is that coming up later? Did I ruin it?
Part two.
So, yeah, to answer your question, she should be seen by I'd say within like 48 hours. You know, just by history alone, you know, this is, you know, 9 times out of 10 going to be a corneal ulcer, poor contact lens hygiene, you know, pretty common occurrence in our clinic. I also want to say that real quick before we go further, in general, the quality of the referrals that I get from primary care are excellent. And it's so different going from residency. Where you just basically you'll see anybody that has an eye, you know. out in private practice, you know, I'm constantly kind of getting referrals from, you know, primary docs, emergency docs, you know, everybody, you know, nearby, and you know, people are good. I'm surprised how much people actually know about ophthalmology sometimes. And so, this is in this case here, this is a patient that. Within 2 days, you should be able to get into an ophthalmologist.
Yeah, I made this mistake with contacts when I was back in college, and I have been out of contacts now for however many years ago that was.
Yeah, it's you know, I'd say most people that get an ulcer like this from poor hygiene do end up back in contacts, and maybe 50% of the time they do get another ulcer. So. You know, you just kind of harp on these on people that, you know, about the you know not sleeping in them, not showering in them, you know, washing, cleaning them appropriately, all that stuff. It's just people just got to keep hearing it, and people who are responsible,
unlike me,
that can handle monthlies. That's fine. Those are good options.
Yeah. I love the facial features when you said that.
the audience can imagine that.
Who I'm referring to in particular here.
Yep. Okay, Carolyn, where are we going next with this case here?
Yeah, I know you said that there are like words in that case that triggered you. So do you mind kind of talking through about like what symptoms in particular like made you worried where she needs to be seen like more urgently rather than in like a week or 2 weeks?
Yeah, so with any eye problem, vision and pain are your best indicators for urgency. You know, especially with issues that involve the ocular surface, the cornea, the conjunctiva. If a patient comes to you and says, you know, this has been getting worse over the past week and now I can't see my hand in front of my face. You know, I'm worried about that patient, obviously. If they're in so much pain, they're getting nauseous or vomiting, that's a major concern. I'm trying to see those patients as soon as I can. And so within a day, you know, certainly if this patient came, you know, to you on a weekday, you know, you really should be able to get them in to see an eye doctor within a day. You know, it's, you know, they obviously are a high risk for an ulcer, which can be pretty devastating, depending on what type of pathogen you're dealing with. It's the infection risk that really makes me concerned and the history of poor hygiene that makes me like, let's get this patient in to see somebody.
So say I am seeing this patient in my clinic and maybe my ophthalmoscope is totally broken. Okay. Absolutely broken. I can't find the batteries. There are no batteries in clinic. So can you kind of, if I had one, I would totally be able to wield its power mightily.
Yeah. You're great at eye exams, Carolyn. I remember that about you.
Yeah. I don't even need to like dilate an eye. I can just see the fundus, you know? So
amazing.
It's a secret magic power that I have. I should add that to my resume.
Yeah.
So, but can you walk us through kind of your approach to an eye physical exam and kind of assume that like our ophthalmoscope in clinic is broken? So what can we do with like the limited tools that we have?
Well, first what you do is you go to your technician and you ask them to do it. and then you just kind of hang out for a while. But if for some reason your technician is broken, technician doesn't have any batteries, then you go in there, you start with the vision. So you're checking each eye separately, all right, with their correction on. So you want them wearing their glasses, their contacts. If vision isn't 20/20, then we're using a pinhole occluder. So just a little tiny, usually like 1.5 millimeter, pinhole, see if the vision improves. If the vision improves, that tells you that's probably like a glasses issue. Chances are, if you're going to all the lengths that you're going through to do this, in-depth eye exam as a non-ophthalmologist, you're not worried about someone just needing new glasses. So after you check the vision, you're checking pupils, each one separately, and then you're checking for an afferent pupillary defect. So seeing if the optic nerve could be affected. And then I can't stress this enough. Turn the lights off when you're checking for pupils. It kills me when I see these medical shows and there's like these bright, grocery store fluorescent lights on, and they just take this little wimpy little flashlight, and just check the pupils. that's not the way to do it. So get the lights off, check the pupils, and then you're checking motility, especially someone that has double vision. You're checking confrontation, visual fields. And then we always check eye pressure. I think that's something that anybody can really do with a tonopin. I don't know if you guys have ever used a tonopin.
No.
Ever?
I don't know that they're commonly stocked in a primary care clinic.
Probably not.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't be a bad idea. You don't have to be afraid to do eye stuff in any clinic.
including
checking
afraid.
Pressure. and then if after checking the pressure, that's when you make the decision whether or not you need to dilate the patient. So that's kind of in a nutshell. And all that honestly takes about two or three minutes.
So the checking the pressure, I don't know that people are doing that in the internal medicine, like primary care office, because I just don't think the tonopens are available.
I don't think they are.
But how do you link that to the need to dilate the eye or not? Is that because like you're looking for glaucoma or?
Well, it's not so much the pressure that decides whether it's why the patient's there.
Okay.
So if someone's in there, comes in for an ocular surface problem, I think they have blepharitis, dry eye, something I know is just kind of the front surface of the eye. I don't necessarily have to dilate them because, if their vision is good, if I can explain the vision by what their problem is, then there's really no need to dilate them and make it a 30-minute longer visit. Yeah, it's not really the pressure. It's just, what I think might be going on.
Okay.
Right.
If the vision is normal, then, my worry meter goes way down, for things with red eyes,
So. And I want to get a little bit granular on the ocular exam stuff that you were just saying. So as far as like, let's say we don't have a Snellen eye chart. Do you have like an easy workaround for that? Or let's say we don't have the 20 feet set up, like holding a book.
Where are you
at
working, Matt?
even when I go to the emergency room, I have to hunt around for the eye chart. So, there's probably one somewhere in the clinic somewhere.
Right.
you just have to hunt, you have to find it. But in our clinic, we use a series of mirrors to get us that 20 feet in the exam room. When I'm if you don't have a chart, really, you can just, you know, ask the patient, find out if they think their vision is normal. Mm-hmm. Like what's going on here? Is it more blurry in one eye or the other? Use any kind of reading material you have. You just mm-hmm. pick something. Hopefully they have, if they're, you know, older than 40, hopefully they have reading glasses with them. Mm-hmm. You know, I would recommend just having a pair of reading glasses in your clinic. So, you know, going to the drugstore, getting a pair of reading glasses and just having them somewhere in those times whenever you don't have any way to really test distance vision, you don't have, you know, a screen large enough, and you want to get a basic sense of how good they're seeing, you can just, and they don't have reading glasses, you just pop them on there, right. You know.
And then you just have them read a couple sentences holding something at reasonable distance.
Exactly. And if they're reading, you know, pretty easily. And then, you know, the things when you're really worried are, you know, if they can't see, and if they're just what we call, you know, hand motion vision or count fingers, where all they can do is count fingers, or they can't even do that. You know, that's when, you know, oh man, something bad's happening here. We gotta figure this out.
Okay.
So, there's more vision besides just either being able to see the big E or not the big E. You know, there's like this whole gradation of vision that you can have, from no light perception to count mountains, you know. So with any of these referrals, like this is for me, my expectation is so low for anybody outside of ophthalmology, you know, being able to diagnose some kind of eye thing, because I know what kind of education I got in med school about eyes, and it's awful.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why I'm never upset about getting a referral, because, you know, you don't have the skills typically to be able to, you know, do things like fundus exams on a non-dilated eye.
I hope all of our consultants are as friendly and as happy to receive our consults as you are.
I just really like eyeballs, and it's not a normal thing. Like
that, no, it's definitely not normal.
Liking eyeball, that's not normal.
So, Dr. G, you were mentioning that primary care doctors actually sometimes surprise you and diagnose things. So that's kind of the point of this talk, is to try to go through some things. So one of the big ones is, like, someone comes to us with a red eye. That's like one of the main concerns in primary care. Can you kind of walk us through how you would break that down?
Yeah. So the first thing is, again, doing an assessment of, you know, what's their main complaint that they're coming in for with the eyes, because that can really point you in the right direction. So, we'll just go through a couple of examples. Patient comes in with burning pain. My eyes just are constantly burning. They're irritated. It's kind of comes and goes. It's worse at night, or it's worse in the morning. Like my worry meter is going way down, because that is 9 times out of 10, that's going to be blepharitis. Okay. If their vision is okay, then if they're like, oh, my vision is not really affected by this, then I'm like, oh, well, this is not something that's going to be really concerning. And so, you know, that's somebody that, you know, can, next available ophthalmology appointment, you know, you can have them try some artificial tears, hot compresses, kind of these very easy generic things, and, you know, send them off to the eye doctor. Other complaints, another big one is itching. So itching is a big one. That is also 95% of the time going to be allergy. So you'll have someone with a history of allergy. They have, they're just constantly wanting to rub their eyes. That's a lot of time going to be allergic conjunctivitis. Again, not something that's really serious. So burning, itching, it's whenever you start getting these symptoms that are associated with a decrease in vision that you have to be a little bit more vigilant and concerned. Mm-hmm. So that's that's my approach initially is, you know, a lot of times when I look at the chief complaint before I go into the room, I already have a sense of what the diagnosis is going to be, because that really with eyes can tell you a lot.
And if it's a red eye with vision loss, then where do you start to think there?
Yeah. So if you think about it, you know, if the vision is down, that means something in their visual axis is affected. Okay. Certainly just dry eye issues, you know, can cause, you know, dryness to the cornea, can disrupt the surface of the eye and cause a decrease in vision. And, you know, that would be, again, those like burning sensation, intermittent blurry vision. So that's on the differential, but you also got to be thinking about other things that can affect the cornea. So corneal ulcer, contact lens wear. So I'm looking at the cornea really closely, making sure there's no sign of infection. Also, if their vision's down, they're having eye pain, they're sensitive to light, so photophobic, then I'm also thinking about intraocular inflammation, so uveitis, which is what we call uveitis, just basically inflammation inside the eye can be, you know, infectious or non-infectious. And so I'm just thinking in terms of what's causing that vision to be down. And that's a big lesson that I learned as a resident. Like, okay, a patient comes in, they were 20/20, now they're 20/40. You got to explain that vision loss. You got to figure that out. And so starting front to back, just looking at all the ocular structures.
With the patient with the red eye, you know, I know that angle closure glaucoma is one of the things that's on the differential there. Are there a couple other like big ones that we don't want to miss in primary care that we should definitely refer like much more quickly?
So angle closure, it's going to be hard to miss angle closure. Okay. You guys are pretty good about reckoning that. That's like one of the three things you do learn in med school about eyes is how to recognize angle closure. So that's good.
Can you give us a brief review on how to recognize it? What are the key features? Yeah.
So the patient's going to be, their complaint is going to be intense stabbing eye pain. It's always going to be on one side. Bilateral angle closure is unbelievably rare. And so one eye is going to be involved. Their vision is going to be down. They're going to be potentially nauseous and vomiting. One sign is, well, if they're Asian descent, so, you know, Asian populations, they tend to see more, more angle closure. And so they just tend to have more hyperopia, so they're more farsighted. So that's another sign that you can look for is you find out if they're wearing glasses, you look at their glasses, and if they're basically like big magnifying glasses,
yeah,
then you know they're farsighted. Their eye is smaller, and so it's more, there's just not enough room inside the eye for the drainage system to work, and sometimes it can close off, and that's when you get a buildup of pressure.
Okay.
And so yeah, highly farsighted people, much higher risk for angle closure. But other things, yeah, things that would just walk into your primary care clinic, uveitis is one thing. So herpetic disease.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of people get herpes.
Yeah.
And
I've been told that.
Yeah, real common, real common. And so, you know, photophobia is something to be concerned about, new onset photophobia. Okay. Yeah, with decrease in vision.
So we talked a lot more about the differential. Do you mind kind of walking us through how you would treat sort of like the viral versus allergic versus bacterial conjunctivitis? So that is something I think primary care physicians do a lot of time for.
No, that's a really important topic, because that's going to be probably one of the biggest things that you see. So first of all, let's start with bacterial conjunctivitis. This is very rare. You know, and whenever you see it, it's really hard to miss. So if you go and you look at a patient's eyes, and it makes you want to put a biohazard suit on, you know, there's a possibility that they have bacterial conjunctivitis. So their eyelashes are going to be kind of matted with purulent, you know, yellowish, you know, greenish discharge. their eyelids are going to be really edematous and red and inflamed. You're going to see this primarily in kids. You know, it's more, it seems to be more common in kids, or adults that have been in the hospital or, nursing homes, you know, kind of more dirty environments. You're going to see, a little bit higher chance of bacterial conjunctivitis. And we'll talk in a second about how to treat it, but with viral, so viral is, not as in your face, you know, it, so to speak. You're going to have like a mucoid kind of whitish discharge. It's going to be much thinner. The eyes are going to be a little red. They might have a recent viral illness. So they've been coughing, runny nose. It's just not that impressive the vast majority of the time. So the patient may come to you with a complaint of red eyes and kind of irritation, a little bit of pain. And you look at him, you're like, oh yeah, I guess it's kind of red. You know, that's probably, it's either going to be viral conjunctivitis or it's going to be nothing, blepharitis or something. So you think about like sick contacts, you know, recent exposures to other people with colds. The two caveats with viral that you have to think about is the first one is adenovirus. So adenovirus can cause big problems. It can make the eyes look just beet red. And when people say adenovirus or when people say pink eye, then that's really what pink eye refers to in my mind, at least, is adenovirus, because it's incredibly infectious. And so, I learned early on, you never say pink eye to a patient. That's like a mom who's brought their kid in who doesn't, you know, everything's going to, is kind of okay. But the minute you say, oh, this could be pink eye, you know, sirens go off. That's all the patient can think about. So adenovirus, really deeply red, you know, a lot of times the cornea is not affected, so they usually still have normal vision, at least right away. You'll feel lymph nodes, so you feel for preauricular lymph nodes. The other viral conjunctivitis you got to think about is herpes. We kind of touched on that. So history of cold sores on the lips or mouth. They don't look quite as impressive as adenovirus. You can get an adenovirus or a herpes conjunctivitis, but typically you get more cornea problems with a herpetic infection. Yeah.
I just wanted to break in about this. So, you know, daycares have this rule, like you have to be on treatment for 24 hours. So like, even though it's probably clearly not a bacterial infection, everyone gets drops, even if it's viral. And then they're on drops for 24 hours and then they can come back to daycare and spread around their viral conjunctivitis. It, I don't know, Dr. Glockenflecken, does that make sense to you? Or,
I mean, you know, we see that all the time, pretty much, you know, erythromycin just flows like water.
Yes.
That's like the go-to, you know, it's really not doing anything, you know, it's peace of mind kind of thing. And it's a little bit different than systemic antibiotics. You know, you're not, obviously the concern for antibiotic resistance is still, you know, you want appropriate use of antibiotics. And sometimes it's hard to examine kids, you know, so sometimes it's really hard to get close to their eyes to really get a good sense of, okay, is this bacterial? Could this be bacterial? Could this be viral? I try not to fault anybody for like just deciding, okay, I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to start them on erythromycin. But the whole, you know, when to go back to school issue, to be completely sure that you're going to clear the virus, you really got to probably be out of school for like, you know, 3 to 5 days.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's, but the caveat being, I think a lot of what's called conjunctivitis really isn't an infectious process. Mm-hmm. You know, kids can get blepharitis too. You know, kids can get stuff in their eyes. They can rub their eyes. They can, there's lots of things that can give a red eye to a kid. And so true viral conjunctivitis, you know, 24 hours, that's probably not, that's probably not enough, even after getting a, you know, an erythromycin, which they probably didn't need in the first place.
Erythromycin is the ointment that's usually given, right, for kids anyway? Because okay.
And the reason it's so good, like water. Yeah, exactly. Well, it shouldn't flow like water. It's probably expired if it's water. The reason it's so good for kids is because it's thick. It's ointment, you know, so it stays on the eye, because kids are gonna, you know, go crazy whenever you try to put anything in their eyes. Mm-hmm. So you want something thicker that's gonna stick around. They're not gonna just cry it out.
We haven't really touched on drops, like different medications. Mm-hmm. Okay, one thing that I just want everyone to stop using is sulfacetamide. Sulfacetamide. I don't know where people are getting these drops, but it doesn't do anything. It's not. There's so many better options than like just your basic sulfa drop. And so, real quick, just some good medications. And I don't have any financial interest in any medication. Drop. I don't even know how to get a financial interest in a medication.
And if you could use generic names, our sponsors like us to only use generic names.
So if a patient comes in with a corneal abrasion, you know, they need to be put on an antibiotic, like, to prevent, what you're basically doing is just preventing an infection from setting in. And so my go-to for that would be, it's a combination drop, polymyxin B, sulfamethoxazole. Okay. So it is a sulfa, but it's also got a bactericidal component to it, which is the polymyxin B. It's pretty much dirt cheap. And so it's really effective. It's broad spectrum. So it's great for preventing, you know, a bacterial infection on top of a corneal abrasion. It's also a good option for small, localized corneal ulcers, like contact lens related ulcers. So if you're going to start a patient, this happens a lot. Patients will come into me with a corneal ulcer from a contact lens or whatever, and they'll already be on a drop. So Polytrim is a good one you can do. If it's a really minor, small little infection, ofloxacin is one that I will use frequently. It's a second generation fluoroquinolone. For your bigger, nastier looking infections, then that's a little bit more broad spectrum. I'll go with moxifloxacin or gadifloxacin. Okay, moxifloxacin is in general easier to find, I've found. And that's a great, that's like our, we use it at the end of most of our cataract surgeries. You know, it's a fantastic antibiotic that's broad spectrum and gets rid of nasty Pseudomonas ulcers for the most part, which is the big thing we get concerned with contact lens related infections. So in adults, those are the three antibiotics that I use most frequently. Okay. We talked about erythromycin. So great for kids because it's an ointment. It's also useful for blepharitis because it helps decrease the inflammation in the eyelids. And so I'll give it to patients, to adults, to use it at bedtime, like right before bed. So you get that patient that's coming in, dry eyes, burning, kind of irritated. Everything else looks fine. You think they probably have just run-of-the-mill dry eye blepharitis. You can give them some erythromycin to just put in at night and just, helps lubricate the eye overnight. You know, a lot of your patients probably have sleep apnea. And so they're, you know, wearing CPAP, it's blowing in their face, drying out their eyes, right? Give them some erythromycin ointment to use at bedtime. Works great. So that's my spiel on antibiotics. I don't really think there's any other, I'm trying to think, I can't think of any other ones that I kind of will frequently use. Yeah.
What about olopatadine for allergic or vernal
conditions? Yeah, I do. I love olopatadine. That's good. That's my favorite prescription allergy drop. Excellent. For sure. Yeah. Ketotifen is a good over-the-counter allergy drop. So that's also really effective. Olopatadine is just a little bit better.
What about the over-the-counter redness drops? Can you overdo it with those? Can patients overdo it with those?
I mean, have I told you yet that if I could just blast all the Visine in the world off into the sun and get rid of it, I would. So yes, you can overdo it with redness relievers.
Okay.
Just there's just no reason, unless you're, you know, smoking weed and trying to hide it from your parents. Like, I can't think of any other reason for a redness reliever.
I believe that's a pretty big market, though. Not that listens to this show, but just like in general out there in the world.
Right. The reason that's so bad, and you can tell this to your patients, that, you know, it's a vasoconstrictor primarily, but there's a reason that your eyes are red. And so, sure, it's going to get rid of the red and it's going to vasoconstrict everything, but then it's just going to come roaring back and it's going to be worse and it's not going to actually solve anything. So anyway, that's why the redness reliever really isn't helpful.
But artificial tears, can we go to town on those things?
Go to town, man. Just crush them.
Okay.
You know, use them by the gallon full. No, that's fine. I mean, you can't, you know, overuse those. You know, the artificial tears are great. I give them out all the time. Yeah.
Any other favorite eye medications?
Well, no, just in general, stay away from steroids on the eyes.
Right.
Unless they've seen an ophthalmologist. Okay. So if you think they need a steroid for whatever reason, just let us handle the steroids.
Okay.
Yeah. That's it. In general, I don't notice a problem with that for the most part.
Yeah.
It's just something to keep in mind.
We actually have a question from Twitter earlier today from one of our followers. So The question asks, well, it's a little bit of an unusual question, so I haven't heard it. So I'm interested to hear your perspective. So it says, I've heard it before that breast milk can be a great substitute for antibiotic drops when it comes to babies with pink eye. Is this EBM or antidote? Thinking of the all natural patients. So if we brought to our attention that this is a viewpoint. So I was wondering, how would you address this? Yeah.
Well, I got to say, out of all the bodily fluids I've heard of people putting in their eyes recently, this is probably the least offensive one. I honestly can't speak to the benefits of breast milk in the eyes. I don't know what's in breast milk. You guys know?
Well, if the mom's on antibiotics, there might be some antibiotics in there.
Yeah, there you go. I certainly don't know of any evidence to support that. Yeah, that I don't know.
I just figured I had to ask. So
yeah, I'd say if you're thinking about putting breast milk in your child's eyes, then yeah, it might be a decent idea to maybe you could go see an eye doctor, any doctor really. That's my opinion. So
what is the correct way to use an eye drop bottle?
I posted about this on Twitter a while back. Certainly you can do the traditional squeeze from the middle. But I posted was a video of me, this is something I learned in residency, of just pushing the bottom of the bottle. That's actually how a lot of the bottles are made. They're made to actually be pushed from the bottom and it pushes a drop out. And the advantage of that is it has more of a controlled release. So if you squeeze from the side, you're more likely to waste some of the drops. If you push from the bottom, you're really only going to get one drop out. So that's the advantage of that. And it's also sometimes easier for people with arthritis who can't really squeeze. All you got to do is kind of mash on the bottom of the bottle and it'll come out.
That blew my mind when I when I heard that.
It's kind of like the TED Talk on the entire shoes.
I was just kind of, I was bored at clinic. I had some downtime in clinic and I just,
It's like, all right, maybe people don't know this. I don't know. So I just threw this video up there, and then it just, people went nuts over it. Again, I need to stop underestimating the lack of general knowledge there is out there about eyeballs and all things related to eyeballs.
Yeah. What is, by chance, what is your favorite opto abbreviation?
All right. This is going to be a tough one. This is I'm going to tell you, I'm going to give you a one liner here. And I want you to tell me anything you can about.
Uh-oh.
Oh, no.
Did he freeze up?
That was the absolute worst time for him to freeze.
Great for building up suspense, though.
Yeah.
Little do we know, he's not actually frozen. He's just holding us hook, line, and sinker.
Sorry, guys.
That's all right. You had us hanging there.
The last
abbreviation.
Dr. Glockenflecken, we were so worried that you were not coming back, but we're glad you're back. I just, now that I have the hang of saying the name, I just like saying the name.
I say it all the time, right?
Yeah.
Did we ask you yet what it actually means? I don't think.
Yeah, we did. You just, no, wait, audience, we didn't ask him on air.
I don't think the audience knows what your name means.
No.
Yeah. So it's really exciting. So just get ready. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
Okay.
Should I bear down?
I want to make sure you're all seated.
Okay.
First. So first, when you have an episode of angle closure glaucoma, this is already getting exciting. I can tell by your faces. when you have an angle closure glaucoma, you have, you get denatured epithelial cells in the lens that clump together. Are you with me?
Yeah, I am.
Still following.
Yeah. So they clump together and you get these little deposits on the surface of the lens, that are called glaucoflecken.
That's amazing.
And I have zero real, like, you know, vested interest in glaucoma, but I really like that word. It's like by far my favorite word in ophthalmology. It's just ridiculous.
Glockenflecken.
There are a lot of ridiculous words in ophthalmology.
So we have one from Trey Partridge. So he's asking, what about the sudden onset of floaters? Does this warrant an urgent opto referral or not?
Good question. That's another big one. So floaters, very common. I'd say sudden onset of floaters. The biggest thing we get concerned about is a tear in the retina. Okay. Which could lead to a retinal detachment, which is a big deal that requires surgery. So I'd say they should probably see someone. That's like a, you know, within 48 hour type of thing. Yeah. So, you know, and the thing with timing of referrals to ophthalmology, in my opinion, and this is just how it is with my practice, it may not be with other practices, but in general, if you're in an area that is well represented with ophthalmologists, there's really no reason why you shouldn't be able to get someone in within a few days. So if you get pushback from a bunch of ophthalmologists, they're like, oh, we can't get them in that quickly. I mean, that's just bad business. If you're running a private practice, right? You want to be able to get patients in relatively quickly. Because I feel like there's this kind of conception that it's hard to get in to see an ophthalmologist. And that's, you know, it's not always true. But with floaters, going back to the question, yeah, I'd say within a couple of days. You know, what you don't want is for there to be a tear that progresses to a detachment. Yeah, which can happen pretty quickly.
So from @feministio, I'd love to hear about diabetic eye exams and treatments for retinopathy. Are there any advances in the works?
The biggest advance in the past, you know, 10 years has been intravitreal injections. So that's just totally revolutionized treatment for both macular degeneration and diabetic retinopathy. The mainstay is laser treatment for like proliferative retinopathy. And it used to be laser for macular edema as well. But I mean, that gets a little dicey at times when you're using a laser near someone's fovea. You know, it's, in fact, when I went through training, you know, I did maybe one focal laser, that's what we call it, where we're lasering someone's macula real close to, you know, taking out their central vision. And so, you know, I really didn't get trained doing that. You know, most retina specialists, which I'm not a retina specialist, most of them are, they can do that kind of treatment. But now it's, you know, it's injections. That's the biggest thing. And to be honest, I'm not sure what else new is coming in addition to that. You know, they're always, you know, trying to come up with new anti-VEGF medications, which is what the injectables are.
So diabetics who state that their eyes get blurry when their blood sugar is high, how high do you feel the serum glucose has to be for them to start kind of having these symptoms where you can actually like attribute it, you know, to the high hyperglycemia versus, oh shoot, something else is going on because you're having new onset blurry vision?
I'd say that if I get a poorly controlled diabetic in clinic and I can't really figure out anything else wrong with them or why they'd have blurry vision, I'll usually, you know, blame it on the blood sugar. I don't know if there's a really good number, but you know, what I typically see is, you know, people that have had blood sugars in like, 500, 600, you know, even maybe a little bit lower, like 300 or 400, you can very easily see changes in the refraction, which is what you're getting. Which is why the vision is blurry, is the lens is swelling and changing shape and causing a different focal point for the eye. And so you get a change in refraction, which is why we never like to give a diabetic who's poorly controlled a new pair of glasses until we know that they're, you know, that's not an issue, because then they come back and they're not happy. And so, but I'd say it has to be a good amount, you know, over like 200 to really start getting that effect. But I don't have any good evidence behind that. It's just kind of a, you know, gestalt type of thing.
One final question. So have you submitted a petition to officially change ophthalmologist to eye dentist?
Oh man, I feel like I've created a monster with this whole eye dentistry thing. So it's so funny because when I didn't make that term up. Like that's, I think I was the first person that used it where like a lot of people had never heard it before. Whenever I've used it a couple times on Twitter, and I get like angry messages from both dentists and ophthalmologists.
So you know they, you did the right thing.
No one can figure out, you know, who is that's insulting to more, either dentists or probably just both. And so yeah, I tried to do this whole, you know, thread where I, you know, trying to encourage people to use the term responsibly. Which is ridiculous, like that I'm even talking about this. And so I've actually stopped using that on social media, out of respect to the ophthalmologists who don't seem to like it. I personally don't have any problem with the term. I think it's hilarious and it makes perfect sense. It's a great term, but it is used a lot now in like the med Twitter, you know, community. And so I will not be trying to change ophthalmologists to eye dentists or eye dentistry, although I do like the term. But unfortunately, I don't think it's going to catch on.
Well, we can only hope, sir, because I really like the term too.
Yeah, it's very descriptive, isn't it?
It is. It is. Yep. It really, I had never heard it, but it's one of those things, like the first time I heard it, I'm like, oh yeah, I get that. That's.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, ophthalmologists are there. We're kind of just removed from the rest of medicine a little bit. Right. And that's really kind of the main message there is, well, we're kind of like dentists in that we're not really part of like the rest of the medical community, you know? Really, we probably should have our own schools, to be honest. No, I take that back. That's, you know, that would probably be a bad idea. But anyway, I don't know. I get people being up, you know, upset about it, but yeah, whatever. Get over it.
I guess at this point, we should ask about any take-home points you have for the audience.
One point would be, you know, don't hesitate to send a patient or call an ophthalmologist about a patient, you know, who's having eye problems. Because I've certainly seen people that, you know, they tried to kind of just watch a patient for a while, and, you know, things can very quickly go south. Again, we have very low expectations in terms of other people managing eye problems. And so in a lot of ways, I consider myself primary care. Okay. Not like a cardiologist where, you know, a lot of people have a lot more extensive kind of baseline training in heart disease. Okay. No one has that with ophthalmology. You guys don't have that like basic, understanding of a lot of kind of the, you know, more complex eye problems. And so just call us, send the patient to us, and we'll figure it out.
So the last thing, did you want to plug your charity?
Yeah, as I've talked about on Twitter, I am a cancer survivor. Yeah, I got testicular cancer in my mid-20s a couple times, and I've gone through treatment. And during the second time I got cancer, I found a charity called First Descents. They are provide outdoor week-long outdoor adventures for young people who have been affected by cancer. And it's really a fantastic organization. And so what I've started doing is trying to fundraise for them. I've been doing some stand-up comedy, usually for medical audiences. That's as you can tell, I do tend to like to tell jokes, about medicine. If you've noticed,
I've noticed
from my Twitter handle. Yep, that's kind of a thing for me. So anyway, I've been doing that for some medical audiences, and not all the money that I would get for that would go to First Descents. And so check them out. Recommend them to your patients. You know, on my Twitter profile, I have a link that talks about First Descents, and they have a Twitter page that you can look at and learn more.
And we'll put that at the top of the show as well. So this won't be the first time people are hearing this, and we can link it in the show notes. So we'll definitely ask the audience to check out First Descents.
Sweet. Thanks guys.
Okay. So that's it. That's the show. Thank you so much for all of your wisdom, Dr. Glockenflecken. And I'm just trying to show off now that I know how to say the name, which feels great. Stuart?
You should work that in. Anytime you're interacting with an ophthalmologist, try to work that in.
And now we know what it means, too.
That's exactly right. You probably don't even remember.
Sure, it's the crud. It's
like about denatured epithelial cells underneath the lens or something. I don't know.
It's when you call ophthalmologist and you're worried. You're like, I have a patient with glockenflecken.
Just once, I want to get referred a patient for glockenflecken. That would be fantastic.
This has been another episode of the Curbsiders.
It sure has.
Bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yummy.
You can find show notes along with links to any articles, books, websites, or apps mentioned on the show at thecurbsiders.com/podcast. And sign up to receive our weekly mailing list where you'll get a PDF copy of the show notes at thecurbsiders.com/knowledgefood. Send an email to thecurbsiders@gmail.com if you want to recommend a future topic or tell us what you love or hate about the show. We have pages on Facebook, Instagram, and on Twitter at The Curbsiders. Until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto at Dr. Watto on Twitter.
I'm Carolyn Shan out of Cleveland, Ohio.
I'm Nora Toronto out of the University of Chicago.
And I'm Dr. Stuart Kent Brigham at Brigham SK on Twitter. And good night without Paul. Silence for Paul.